I'm Dr. Leif Tappanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History. I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho. This is The Nature of Idaho. Coming from the 1B, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today our guest is Dr. Shannon Kobes-Novotniak, Associate Professor of Volcanology at Idaho State University. Today we'll be talking about the alien landscapes at Craters of the Moon in southern Idaho, and how these volcanic features are helping guide future missions to Mars and the search for life in our solar system.
This is going to be a fun episode. You go up to Craters and you just look at the amazing landscapes, but you really have no idea what type of research.
Well, that's just it. It's all this black rock. It looks like a weird moonscape. And who knew? This is a place that NASA researchers have been coming for years to try to understand on Idaho's soil what's going on in other worlds. So that's pretty exciting.
This is going to be great. But first, let's get into a bit of nature news. All fractured surfaces share a similar characteristic called fractal self-affinity. What that means is that a mountain at geological scale looks identical to the roughness of a solid metal object at nanometer scale. This unique characteristic is often attributed to physics of crack propagation through solid materials, which really has been difficult to model until researchers in Denmark, Switzerland, and the United States figured out what was going on. This fractal self-affinity is due to the smoothing and re-roughing mechanisms via subsurface crack propagation and third body configuration. What does that mean? I think a lot of it is it's rubbing together and breaking. And the cool part is that it's going to help scientists better understand earthquakes and hopefully better predict when one might happen.
That's fascinating. So when you look at something really, really close up, its surface roughness that you see is similar to the kind of roughness that you would see at larger scales like mountain ranges. That's
yes.
The idea.
Yes, it's amazing. And I look at fractal geometry. You know, this is the first time I've come across it within a scale like geology and geography. Scientists have been using fractal geometry to determine the density of tree heights and tree variations in tropical rainforests and other types of things. So it's really kind of neat, again, to see how we can use fractal geometry on just about anything.
Right. You think of branching patterns in leaves and the veins of leaves that they repeat over and over.
Yep.
At different scales, or the branching patterns of tributaries into rivers that repeats at various scales. It's a really neat phenomenon that you can see the forest for the trees in a way, and the trees for the forest through this, this self-similar fractal geometries. Fascinating stuff. Beginning of every show, we try to have a little trivia moment. Today, related to our conversation that we'll have in a moment, we're going to be talking about Craters of the Moon National Monument. And so today's trivia question is, what year and which president made that monument a reality right here in Idaho? Right after the break, we'll meet our guest and we'll eventually answer that question.
Good stuff.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Well, welcome back to the show. And I want to welcome our guest, Shannon. Thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho. And so I introduced you as an associate professor of volcanology. Shannon, can you tell us what you do for a living?
Well, the easy answer is that I get to chase mountains that explode on their own, which is the coolest job ever.
That does sound pretty fun.
I mean, you guys have some pretty good ones, but I'm just going to say that I've got you beat on that front. So I play with volcanoes, and I'm a physical volcanologist, which means I'm really interested in the processes that are behind, what's the actual physics behind it, as opposed to some volcanologists are more worried about things like chemistry. So I worry about how lava flows and how eruption columns interact with the atmosphere.
So now, Idaho, do we have volcanoes bursting off and blowing up around here? I haven't seen a blowing up volcano around here lately.
You're just too young, Leaf.
I am too young. Yes. So we can't see that on the radio.
So we actually have evidence from the oral traditions from the area tribes, the Shoshone-Bannock tribes, that they were witnessing volcanic eruptions here in Idaho between 5,000 and 6,000 years ago.
Oh, cool. Where do we know of that sort of history?
So some of the most recent stuff we've got is Craters of the Moon and also Hell's Half Acre. Craters of the Moon extends down south. A lot of people don't think that Wapa and King's Bull, if you're familiar with that area, it's just up from American Falls Reservoir. That's actually still part of Craters of the Moon. So that collection had a big eruption around 6,000 years ago, a bunch of pulses of lava flows. And shortly after that, about 5,000 years ago, we get some eruptions going on at Hell's Half Acre over towards Blackfoot.
So when we look at geological time, 5,000-6,000 years ago, that's
like now, right?
It's like now. It's happening right now.
Right.
Yeah, so geologically, it's very recent. And places like Craters of the Moon, most of the volcanoes we have in the eastern Snake River Plain only erupt once. They're this kind that likes to just erupt once, and then effectively it plugs its own plumbing system. And so it can't get past that solidified magma. It has to come up with another crack. Craters of the Moon is really unusual here in Idaho because it keeps using the same system. And so that one's really cool. We know that we actually have these regular eruptions every so often, and we're actually coming up statistically on being able to have another one. That does not mean we're seeing activity, but it means that chances are really good the next 100 years that we could have another eruption.
So could you tell us a little more? So we'll talk about Craters of the Moon, the area itself, but since you started talking about maybe the predictability and the repetition of eruptions, how do you go about trying to suss out the history? And then I guess you're looking at how frequently these repeat and maybe making a prediction in the future. How does that work, and how do you make those kinds of ages, I guess, or inferences?
So the big thing is trying to find something we can date. Okay. Lava flows can be hard because you hear about older rocks and we have all these different radiometric techniques, but lava flows are young. And I just realized I accidentally said that Craters was 6,000. I meant 2,000. So, you know, you chop it down even shorter.
So like 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, basically, like on my way in, yeah. Right? So it's really recent. For those dates that young, we were looking for carbon dating. We're looking for where the lava flow went over top of a tree, something like that. And so we actually are looking for carbon underneath so we can pull that out and get these carbon dates and put together a series of when they've last erupted.
That's amazing. So, yeah, 2,000 years, again, that's long in human terms, but in geologic time, that's a blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. And so is there a notion that these could erupt again in the future? And is it sort of expected that they would at some point in the future?
So I'm not really worried about Hell's Half Acre re-erupting, because that's the kind of volcano that's pretty common out here that only goes once. So something next to it could go, but it probably itself won't erupt again. But Craters actually started erupting. What we think of as craters right now goes back as far as 15,000 years, and it's had about 8 pulses in between. So it's about every 2,000 years or so we get a nice eruptive sequence. The one 2,000 years ago was actually really big. It was a beautiful one. And we don't actually know how much further before 15,000 years ago it was going. It's just that we have a whole lot of dirt that was dumped on from the glaciers that stopped at that point in time. So we see this stuff really well exposed after the glaciers stopped dumping dirt into the valley. So we know that Craters has erupted frequently. It's got a regular-ish sort of time pattern, but that's no guarantee for the future. So it seems likely, but I can't promise you anything.
So when you're sitting there with Craters, do you have any type of technology, you know, seismographs, et cetera, that might be able to detect lava flow? It's magma when it's under the ground. It's magma, correct?
Yeah.
So can you detect movement under the ground that helps give you an idea of how active it still is, even though we don't see anything up top?
So there is active work watching for seismicity on the plain right now. One of the problems is that having all those stacks of lava flows with dirt in between and get those lava tubes, big void spaces, it's really hard for those seismic waves to be able to traverse through. It's basically like an entire area made out of insulation that's actually dampening those effects. So it's hard to be able to see it. Some of the other things that we look for are deformation of the whole ground surface. The entire thing will start to swell as it's getting closer to erupting. And so we can actually use satellites that will tell us motion on the range of millimeters. and the vertical as it kind of rises up or goes down. A lot of active volcanoes will sort of breathe. They'll sort of go up and down over time. And right now we're not seeing anything like that there. We're not seeing any sort of seismic noise. It's nice and calm and quiet. But I'm really hoping to get to see an eruption during my lifetime because I think it would be fantastically cool. And this is the sort of eruption that's going to give us big lava flows. It might give us a scoria cone in the beginning. It's not going to be like Mount St. Helens, where it's, you know, Mount St. Helens had an ash cloud that circled the Earth twice. This is actually instead going to be very accessible tourism-style volcanism. The same way that people travel to Hawaii to look at the lava lake, we'd be having people traveling out here to check it out, and it would be fantastic for me to actually get to see this in action here in Idaho.
So for folks that have gone to the visitor center, for example, at Craters of the Moon, I've been out there a number of times, and you see this sort of black landscape. It's really, you know, we were talking earlier about the bumps on the surface of the Earth scaling at the smallest scales and that sort of thing. I mean, that is the bumpiest surface on the planet that I can think of. And walking over it, it crunches and crumbles, and it's a bit painful to walk over.
I can one-up you even. Yeah. Some of the lava flows out there, we've actually been doing studies with our NASA projects for how rough they are. And some of them at Craters of the Moon are registering as some of the roughest measured surfaces on the planet Earth.
That's amazing. Yeah.
It's wild. It's so rough. And we care about measuring that in part because we want to know how fractally self-similar it is. So just like you were talking about earlier, is it the same at the big scale of the small scale? Well, that would mean if I'm looking at it with a poor resolution satellite image and measuring the roughness, then I actually might have a sense for how rough it really is at the scale that I could have an astronaut or a rover traversing. But if it's not self-similar, because different things will have different degrees of self-similarity, then what I can see doesn't necessarily tell me how much it's going to change as I zoom in. So we're actually using very high-resolution topographic maps down to 2 centimeters per pixel in some cases to be able to understand how that roughness scales and if we can actually extrapolate that to Mars, the Moon, and other surfaces.
We've edged into the conversation here about NASA's longstanding interest in craters of the Moon. And this might be a surprise to a lot of our listeners, but for quite a long time, space exploration and understanding other worlds, not our own, has been sort of a natural lab for studying exotic places. Can you talk a little bit about why Craters of the Moon is important for this kind of work and what kind of work we're doing today out there?
Absolutely. So Craters of the Moon was originally named really as a publicity thing. Is Craters of the Moon. It's so bizarre looking. It's so unusual. But at that point in time, we didn't really know what the moon honestly looked like. So it turns out to be really lucky that we've got so many of the same features. We have features in Craters of the Moon National Monument and Preserve that are identical to features on the real moon. So it creates this great laboratory for us to be able to understand. NASA started using craters in the 1960s as part of their training program for Apollo astronauts, getting them out into the field, trying to prepare them for the sorts of weird lava flows and shapes that they could actually experience up in space. Because the people they were sending, these weren't geologists. They weren't normally going to have seen this. They're training these test pilots to be astronauts to go represent all of science. And how do you do that? So the best way to do that is to get them to the closest place you can find that's similar to that. Earth-based analog studies, like what we do at Craters of the Moon and other places, are critical for improving our chances of success. You don't get to ask questions with nearly the same ability if you're in a spacesuit on Mars that you can if you're actually training on Earth in a location because you understand how things work before all the stakes are on the table.
So are we looking at, like, with the Mars rover, were they practicing and figuring that out here at Craters of the Moon before they, was it 13, 14, 15 years ago it landed?
Well, so Steve Squires, who's one of the leads for Spirit and Opportunity, was actually part of our NASA project called FINESSE, Field Investigations to Enable Solar System Science and Exploration. And he came out and he looked at the lava flows at Craters of the Moon. And originally we were going to try and have rovers out there and have them working in conjunction with our simulation astronauts. And he basically just started laughing wildly and said there was no way he could safely drive one of the rovers in what we've got. It's so rough. So we didn't actually get to deploy one of the rovers or sort of precursor rovers at Craters of the Moon. Instead, I'm not even joking, Steve just picked up heavy things and started carrying them himself. This rock star of space exploration. He's like, well, can't drive my rover here. Looks like I'm going to have to carry it. coming together and working together to solve these things. But that also tells us that maybe what we're looking at Craters of the Moon, we've got questions there that are important to science, that maybe we need to think about how to reevaluate transportation to be able to get our astronauts around on the moon, on Mars. How do we get them there? How do we get them there safely in their suits? It's not acceptable to just slice your suit open a little bit. It's not a problem if I scuff my boots here. Mm-hmm. Much more of a deal up there.
Right. So there are a lot of logistics that I think you want to nail down.
Absolutely.
In a safe environment and practice and practice and practice before you do the real deal. When lives are on the line, lots mm-hmm. of money and resources are on the line, and you're doing it for real in a foreign world. I guess it's amazing to me that there's a place on Earth that mirrors so closely what you might find on the moon, for example. And I guess not every place on Earth is going to mimic a place on the moon. So mm-hmm. what is so special, I guess, and what allows Craters of the Moon to be such a good comparison or analog to places like the moon or Mars?
So the moon is, compositionally, it's really similar to the Earth's mantle. And so it's really primitive magmas. It's low silica, high iron, high magnesium. These are things. It's also true for Mars. And the lavas that we have here at Craters of the Moon are also really primitive. They're very different from something that you'd get in the Cascade Range, for example, where we've got different processes. Those Cascadia volcanoes, we actually have subduction. The ocean floor is falling underneath the continents, being pulled down. And water and melt is coming up from there, and it gets you this really sticky, silica-rich magma that's very explosive. The stuff that we have here is stuff that's coming up from much deeper in the Earth. It's not going through all of that recycling. And because it's not really being affected by plate tectonics, it's much more similar to what we see on Moon and Mars, which also don't have plate tectonics. So compositionally, it comes out pretty similarly. And then that means the shapes it can form are similar. Now, the scales can be really different. So Inferno Chasm is this really great rill that's part of Craters of the Moon, down in the southern zone for it, where it looks like a tadpole has been sort of carved into the landscape, where it's sort of this circular part with a head and then a tail wiggling off from there. It looks identical to lunar rills, but it may be 10% the size. Because we have different gravity, different atmosphere, that's going to change how it cools and how easily it flows. So what we see is that these things are the same, just they're a little bit smaller on Earth, and frankly, that makes them more accessible.
So I've got one of those why questions. Mm-hmm. So when I think of lava forming volcanoes like the ones you're describing, I think of Hawaii. Mm-hmm. I think of Iceland. Those are islands. We're in the middle of, the mountains, it feels like, right? And why on earth do we have this kind of volcanic history, very young history, happening right here in our backyard?
Thank Yellowstone.
Thank you, Yellowstone.
Yes. So Yellowstone, we actually have this deep plume coming up, and you can think of it almost like a blowtorch hitting the underside of the continental crust as it's going by, and it's melting it, and it's incorporating it. And because it's hitting those mountains originally, it's melting that sort of material, it's incorporating that in, and we get those really big explosive eruptions that we think of with Yellowstone. But what's left over after the destruction is still that material that's coming up from the plume. It's the stuff that was then melted and left over that's where the destruction has been. And that's our really primitive magma that hasn't gotten mixed with all this continental stuff. All that's already gotten destroyed, all that high silica. So that's actually given us this beautiful field, Eastern Snake River Plain, in the wake of Yellowstone, where these things have come up. One of the things that's really interesting is that while Yellowstone has progressed sequentially in space, so it used to be over with Oregon, and now it's up, we're losing it into Wyoming, Montana, as it's crossed Idaho, the volcanoes in its wake, the ones in the Eastern Snake River Plain, don't follow that time pattern. They're effectively random. I mean, they can't go out further than the Yellowstone hotspot, but in that wake behind them, they'll pop up anywhere. So we don't actually see them just getting younger as we get closer to Yellowstone itself. It actually bounces around.
So you talk about the pure magma and lava. Do you also then, are you able to get a good idea of what our core is made up? It sounds like our lava flows are coming up and they're not being mixed with anything. So are we also using craters and our volcanoes to really look at what the core of the Earth is composed of?
So the stuff isn't actually coming from the core.
Okay.
So we know that we've got a solid metal inner core and a liquid metal outer core, and that's where we get our magnetic field. This is moving metal. And then we've got the mantle. So if you're going to think of the Earth as like a peach, the crust that we live on is the skin of that peach. It's very, very thin. Turns out it's critical for everything that we do, but super thin. Then the mantle is that big fleshy part of the peach that you eat. And then down by the time you get to the pit, now you're talking about the different layers of the actual core itself. So we've got this material that's coming up to give us the original Yellowstone eruptions. It's coming from very deep in the mantle. And so we compare the material that we get there to material that we get in other places where we have these deep sources, kind of like you were talking about for Hawaii, and we can try and find what they have in common. It's not uniform. It's not this perfectly mixed magical sort of thing. It's complex and it's hard to see down there. But we do sometimes get useful data for sure about what's going on in there. That's just not my specialty.
Okay.
So Craters of the Moon, obviously, if you haven't been there, this is a definite place to put on your list to go hiking around. Mm-hmm. I know, Shannon, you spent a fair amount of time out there. I know some of your field work happens to be during the summer, which sounds like maybe a challenging time to work on black rocks in a very hot sun. Could you tell us a little bit about some of your adventures out there? How are your shoes?
Right. You know, as a volcanologist, I have to like go for a whole nother level of hiking boot, right? My boots don't last very long. I shred them. Because we're doing work with research permits, we're leaving the trails, we're heading out into the lava, and it's sharp. It will cut things up in your boots. It's hard to find a spot to sit down to eat your lunch during the day. The heat coming radiating back off of the rock itself can be pretty intense. We had real challenges a couple years back. We were up there with the NASA Basalt Project, and we were doing work as simulation astronauts. So we've got these giant, heavy backpacks. You know, all of us insist they're 60-some pounds, so the person who designed them says that we're liars. So, you know, you can take it up with him, arguing with NASA. But these very heavy backpacks that have computer systems in them that give us all of our ability in the field as fake astronauts to communicate via video, audio, all the rest, to a mission control team that's guiding us from ARCO.
In air-conditioned rooms?
But sometimes the air conditioning did break.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
so once
horrible.
In a while, they got a little bit,
okay.
You know, warm.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, they were in a special air-conditioned trailer. It was gorgeous. But we found those backpacks when we were in the field. They would turn themselves off when they got to 165 degrees Fahrenheit. And we learned that because they kept turning themselves off. Now, there's the insulated pad between you and that computer, so it's not like you have that pressed directly against you, but oh my gosh, was that hot. When your computer decides it's too hot to participate, it turns out that also doesn't let you go home. That means you have to figure out a way to cool it down in the shade, fanning it while you're still strapped in, fully wired, so that way you can get it to turn back on and keep going with your mission.
So there is shade out there, though.
In a few magic places.
Gotcha. And yeah. You found them all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in the areas that we were working on, You get motivated real fast to figure out where those shady spots are. But one of the things that's really interesting, thinking back to some of what we're doing for these NASA projects, is considering this life. Are we alone in the universe, all right? So think about shade on those lava flows and think about which sides of a rock are the ones that actually have lichen. Even though the rock itself is the same, maybe the direction it's facing, how much shade it's getting, how much sunlight it gets, totally controls how livable it is. And so while we weren't studying the lichen, we were actually looking for microbes that are living inside the rock to figure out how are they surviving there, not just even on stuff that blows in, but on actual energy they're getting from eating parts of the rock itself, getting the nutrients from the elements in the glass.
The notion that, again, this bizarre, extreme landscape that we have here in southern Idaho is the place where we can try to address questions about our place in the universe, and are there other living systems that could be found elsewhere, and how we might go about finding them. It's absolutely fascinating to me. Shannon, I really want to thank you for being here and talking with us. We could do another half hour, hour of this easily. But we have a trivia question.
Oh, yes.
And there is an answer to this trivia question that you almost alluded to before, which is the notion that it was named Craters of the Moon as sort of a maybe a publicity kind of stunt. And this preceded all of the moon travel that happened on in this country. So the question I asked, and I'll have you answer. So in what year and which president created Craters of the Moon?
So this one is thanks to President Coolidge in 1924. We can thank him for giving us this fantastic monument.
That's wonderful. And I invite everybody to go out, check out Craters of the Moon at different times of the year, too, because it's a fantastic
place
to go.
We went out in October where it was overcast and clouds were hanging really low on craters. It was just absolutely gorgeous. And after today's episode, I mean, when you go out there, you will look at Craters of the Moon with a different perspective now and really appreciate how amazing that whole setup is. We want to thank Dr. Shannon Kobz-Novotniak for joining us today. To learn more about her work, please visit her website at isu.edu. Shows are recorded here at the studios of KISU Pocatello. Visit us at kisu.org for questions, comments, and audio for all our programs. Our theme music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. And please remember to get outside and enjoy the nature of Idaho.